have a plot, but at least I'm sure of all the things we got. Babe, I got you, babe. I got you, babe. I got flowers.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this special roundtable lockbox edition of the program. We're thrilled to have you. Thank you for all that you've been doing for the lockbox. Keep it coming. WAMC.org. 1-800-323-9262. Thanks to Sarah and Maddie for doing the shout outs this morning. We'll be back to them at 11:30, but you can help out anytime your heart desires. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. Okay, let me introduce everybody. We will get started. We welcome your input, and hopefully you will be, you'll have, you know, comments, thoughts. There's a lot going on. There's a lot to be, you know, upset about. your opinions may vary, of course. We welcome former New York elementary teacher and now second year PhD student at RPI, Sophia Acquisto. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy I said that right, here. Right?
Acquisto? Acquisto, yeah.
Acquisto.
You
Acquisto.
Got it.
I didn't really. Great to have you here. Thank you very much. Former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat who taught at Bard for 6 years, now a senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Ambassador Fred Hoff is on the show. Good morning, sir.
Good morning to you, Joe. Delighted to see you.
Very nice to have you here. And Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman in the house this morning. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. I'm humbled. You give everybody else's intro and talk about what they've done for our country, they've taught or served. I don't quite have that.
You've kept the economy going. What are you talking about?
Somebody's keeping it going, despite everything that's happening.
Oh, yeah. So we'll talk about a lot of that. We have a lot to talk about, a lot of different stories. Yes. Well, what? Okay. Never mind. I'm going to move on. We're all good. I just needed a moment. Okay, here we go. I wanted to check in see the here are the stories that we want to start off with. Let's begin with, we just got breaking news that Barney Frank passed away, by the way. We knew that he was ill. He was in, I believe, in hospice. And so that just crossed the wire that Barney Frank has passed away. We will talk more about that a little bit later on as more information comes available. I guess this is from the Boston Globe. Decades-long fixture in Massachusetts politics and Democratic politics, a veteran U.S. House member, a pioneering gay rights advocate, and a leading figure in the battle to recover from the 2008 Great Recession has passed away. So more on that as we find out that information. Okay, now back to other stuff here, and we go to maybe I'm wrong, and certainly it could be. My brain cannot contort into the way that has this Trump slush fund make sense and be allowed and continue as planned. So we talked about this yesterday, of course, and you know about the agreement that was made. So now we learn that this came as all of this was being discussed at a hearing. The acting attorney general, Todd Blanche, testified on Capitol Hill yesterday on this issue. The Trump administration, this from the Washington Post, the Trump administration officials confronted bipartisan skepticism Tuesday of their deal to resolve President Donald Trump's legal claims against the government as lawmakers panned its $1.8 billion fund to compensate targets of weaponized justice and question a newly revealed provision that could carry significant financial benefits to the president and his family. Yesterday, There were many, many statements that came out. Well, I should say Monday, we were talking about it yesterday morning, but we were talking about this of how the family would not benefit, the family, Trump and the family would not benefit. Then the addendum came. The one-page addendum was posted Tuesday to the Justice Department's website saying that the IRS would be forever barred and precluded, quote, from pursuing unpaid tax claims against Trump, members of his family, or his businesses that arose before the settlement being reached. It was not immediately clear whether the IRS had any open tax audits of the president or his relatives, and the Treasury Department did not respond to requests for comment on the question. But Trump has often complained that he has been the subject of punishing years-long tax inquiries before his years in the White House. While administration officials have said Trump and his family are barred from receiving direct payments from the compensation fund, ending any pending tax investigations certainly could benefit them personally. The new provision to the settlement, which resolved a lawsuit with the IRS, The new provision to the settlement, and we'll get into that. Heather Cox Richardson is arguing this point today that it's not a settlement; it is an agreement, and there is a big difference between those two, obviously. But so the new provision to this, which resolved a lawsuit Trump, his two eldest sons, and his family businesses filed against the agency in January over the leak by a contractor of their confidential tax returns, was dated Tuesday and signed by the acting attorney general, Todd Blanche. Okay, Mark Whitman, what do we make of this?
This is incredible, Joe. I take this as if Donald Trump came into court and he put his hand into a Cookie Monster puppet and a Count Von Count puppet, and he announces to the court, "I'm suing these guys." And the court says, "No, you can't sue puppets that you control. That's not what courts are for. We're not here for performance art." And the court says, "We're going to have to convene and discuss this seriously because we don't think this is the right venue." And in the meantime, Donald Trump comes back, and he and the Cookie Monster have cut a deal for free cookies for all of Trump's friends. Now, let's be very careful about the free cookies. I am really concerned about this because Trump, since the day he took office in this presidency, has done everything he can to do right by those who were part of the insurrection and otherwise support him. He's also, by the way, commuted or reversed convictions for Joe Arpaio and other law enforcement officers who've been convicted of wrongdoing. And I do fear the fact that Trump is reassembling those forces for a day when he might decide to call upon them again. That is a big concern for me. But beyond that, so
may I just jump in and say,
sure.
And part of that concern comes from the timing of this, where it talks up until 2028, right? I mean, the timing of the document and the agreement.
Yeah, the fund expires in December 2028.
Right.
Yeah, I took that as meaning that they weren't leaving this open-ended for any other administration to pay off their cronies. Not so much. But let's just go back. We were on an airplane called Democracy. A bunch of folks from the back tried to storm the cabin and take it over. Before Trump's administration, the last time we saw these folks, they were being led out of the airport in handcuffs to face the law. We're now back on an airplane. It turns out Trump's led all these guys back. They're back in the back of the plane again. Not only that, he's handing them cash to compensate them he's threatening to hand them cash for the time that they spent in jail. And we're supposed to feel sanguine about our plane ride. I do not feel sanguine. But the beautiful part of this is Trump says, "Well, I'm not getting my settlement." It's not a settlement, by the way. It's a piece of paper written by the executive branch and another part of the executive branch, both are which controlled by Donald Trump. And let me tell you, if Chuck Schumer and the Democrats don't stop this, they deserve to all be kicked to the curb. I mean, this cannot stand.
So, okay, my job often is just to stay out of the discussion and not to rant. This one is really hard, I have to say. But let me just say this in
Please.
A way that hopefully doesn't sound like a rant. But to your point, the person who seemed most upset, the person who was most visible yesterday complaining about this, the person who was literally pounding the lectern was John Thune, not the Democrats. It was John Thune who was upset. So that's one point. The second point is, what do they do? That's what I can't really figure out. What exactly can Republicans or Democrats in this case do to reverse this?
Oh, you need to go to the courts. I mean, this is just a piece of paper. I mean, Joe, this is if, I mean, basically, he came back, Donald Trump came back to the court, and he said, well, I get to hand out all these cookies to my friends because the Cookie Monster signed this piece of paper in blue or black crayon. The answer is no, you don't just get to make things up. And then beautifully, right? They're saying, well, Donald Trump doesn't get anything directly from this. And they turn over the piece of paper because it looked like there was crayon on the back. And he has a separate deal with Count Von Count that says, Count Von Count's not going to pursue me for any of my potentially past tax grievances, which the New York Times, by the way, has not that long ago estimated at worth over $100 million. And again, this is just a piece of paper signed by the other hand. There is no way this should be permitted to stand. But aside from the new heights of sort of grift and shakedown, the fact that Donald Trump is in the back of the plane handing out cash to make good on the past the would-be hijackers should make all of us really concerned.
And where did the plane come from?
Oh, yeah, we're on the Emirates plane? Is
yeah,
that? Yeah, very good.
Right.
Very good.
Go. Let's bring it all together, Mark. Sophia.
I've spent a lot of time just trying to figure out the legality of this and looking at how the document says what bothers me the most is the phrasing forever barred, because just how is that legal? I mean, when you think of it's alarming, not just because he can't be audited for his past crimes and tax evasion potentially, but also for the future and his sons. Like, that's insane. That means he could theoretically never have to pay taxes again because he's never being audited or being checked. And I was looking at the federal law that prohibits the president, vice president, and other executive officers from instructing the IRS to start or stop specific audits. It's U.S. Code 2717. It says prohibition on executive branch influence over taxpayer audits and other investigations. And it says, essentially, it's illegal to tell the IRS that they can't audit a president or vice president or someone in the executive office, except any individual other than the Attorney General of the United States, who was Trump's primary personal criminal defense attorney. So I'm just trying to read this and understand it to figure out, does it mean the Attorney General is exempt from being audited, or does the Attorney General decide who does and does not be audited? I'm trying to figure out where the legality is.
That's why the way I took that, I read some of that same treatment too. That's why I had Count Von Count on the other hand.
That's the Count Von Count, the attorney.
Right. Well, because the IRS, there are laws that prohibit the administration from initiating or ceasing tax audits. The only exception is the Attorney General does have that right. So technically, that's why the second, if you look at the back of the page,
yeah.
The first page was signed with the Cookie Monster. The back of the page was signed by Todd Blanche.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason why they did it that way, I believe.
I'm trying to figure out what kind of restraints and checks and balances are supposed to be in place to penalize a president for doing this or acting unlawfully. Because, you know, looking at all the things Trump has done and without penalizations, you think of how Congress has not declared war, but Trump keeps attacking Iran as he pleases. And, you know, there are clear conflicts of interest here that are being used to prevent the Trump family from being audited without congressional approval. No one's decision except Trump's former lawyer. And just Congress does nothing. The Supreme Court does nothing. So I kind of wish young people were peacefully protesting this more. I mean, you know, the Vietnam War was protested in the 70s. We had humanitarian crises in Gaza that were protested within the past few years. I really wish young people were coming more together and organizing about this, because this is really terrifying.
We're up against a break, so I'm going to just hold for a second. When we come back, we'll hear from Ambassador Fred Hoff and continue our conversation in this matter. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We are playing Cher this morning because it's her 80th birthday.
Oh, happy birthday,
how cool is that?
Wow.
Happy birthday, Cher. Very cool. Just an amazing artist and somebody who is very cool and has had, man, what a life. Second part of her memoir coming out later this year. First part came out about a year ago, and wow. I'm glad there's another volume because I have a lot of questions.
I can actually say, Joe, that I once attended one of her many farewell concerts.
I did too, Fred. Yes, it was. I think it was like maybe a 30-year swap.
Yeah,
there,
at least 11
tour.
Years.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
I also recommend, I'm a memoir person. I love listening to memoirs as audiobooks when they are the narrator.
Yeah.
It's like listening to them
cool.
tell their own story. Yeah. Highly recommend that.
Good stuff. All right, Fred, what do you make of the slush fund?
Well, first of all, I mean, one of the several Justice Department clarifications that's been issued, and, you know, God only knows the validity of these things, but the Justice Department has said that the ban on prosecuting the president or members of his family on tax issues only applies to current issues. Not to things that may be brought forward in the future. You know, Joe, occasionally we'll get letters from listeners, and it's certainly not the majority sentiment out there in terms of WAMC listeners. But occasionally we'll hear from someone saying, you know, you guys are just, you're totally unbalanced. You've got Trump derangement syndrome.
Yes.
You're not saying anything on behalf of the president. I would just like to point out that on this particular issue, it ought to be conservatives more than anyone else outraged by this particular procedure. And I'd just like to point to an editorial today in my favorite newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, where, among other things, the journal says Mr. Trump's settlement fund is an astounding precedent. And if it proceeds, it is sure to become a highlight reel of Trump administration payments to Mr. Trump's friends and allies. Imagine the fun Democrats will have documenting it all between now and 2028 as the worst kind of Washington political payoff, unquote. Now, what the journal seems to be assuming is that these payments and the recipients will be made public. It is not at all clear to me right now that this board being set up is going to be transparent.
We know
procedurally,
but we know if any member of this board does not pass the Trump test, then they're gone.
They're gone. President retains the right to fire anyone. Yeah.
We know that.
Yeah.
We also know that already there is one, perhaps two, claims already in for this particular fund. But you're right. Finding out that information and keeping track of it should be very interesting.
Very interesting. And another one of my favorites, the Atlantic has pointed out that the president is becoming more and more open about his interest in rewarding people who are in his orbit. As you know, Mark mentioned that several people have received extraordinarily generous treatment from the president. There's a cryptocurrency billionaire whose company facilitated a very, very, very lucrative deal with the Trump family. He was pardoned. A tax cheat whose mother attended a $1 million per person fundraiser for the president's campaign, pardoned last year. A couple of reality TV stars whose daughter advocated for his reelection at the Republican convention last year, pardoned. Joe, you know, I listened to your interview, I guess it was last week, with the former FBI director, James yes. Comey, a superb interview. And I noted that Mr. Comey, quite properly, I think, declined to speak about a matter for which he's recently been indicted, something involving seashells or
Shellgate.
Shellgate. Yes. Okay. Well, look, I'm not a huge fan of Mr. Comey. I must admit, I think he demonstrated appalling lack of judgment during the 2016 presidential campaign, and precisely because his judgment is poor, I wouldn't be particularly surprised to see him apply for a grant. From a fund that, in my view, is, to say the least, legally questionable and absolutely improper. But if anyone wants to bet that James Comey will be compensated for lawfare prosecution, I'd be happy to take your money.
He said last night on CNN that he jokingly said, "I'll have my lawyers look at it, but I don't think I'm on the list."
Probably not.
By the way, Fred, I'd just like to add to your point. In addition to the pardons and the clemency that Trump has offered, the tally of the restitution that Trump has erased. So this was money that people had been ordered by courts to pay to victims. Right. Is over $2 billion, depending on how you calculate it. So this fund actually isn't his first time reaching into the cookie jar. Look, the Constitution is what allows for the disbursement of what governs the disbursement of funds from our federal government, and it gives the power of the purse to Congress. The administrative branch does not get to stick its hand in the back of a puppet and write itself agreements to circumvent the Constitution. And the legislative branch and the courts need to get on this. If you remember during the Obama administration, Republicans in Congress were upset, to put it politely, when the funds, the penalties that were paid by banks because of the misdeeds during the leading up to the mortgage crisis, when those funds were earmarked by the administration and by courts for different groups that were advocating on behalf of those who needed assistance with housing payments, the Republicans in Congress were up in arms because they saw it as a circumvention of their power of the purse. This is even worse. We don't have the courts sanctioning this. As I said, this is just one hand of the administration signing a piece of paper with another. This is not constitutional on any planet, even on planet
Trump.
Well,
and Mark, as the acting attorney general pointed out yesterday, there is a precedent for this, that apparently this fund was used by the Obama administration in a $680 million compensation deal involving a case that alleged the Agriculture Department discriminated against Native American farmers. But as the Wall Street Journal points out, not exactly a beacon of left-wing progressivism in the United States. That Obama procedure went through the courts and was approved by the judge, and it had nothing to do with the personal equities of President Barack Obama.
It had nothing to do with Obama was not in the title of the of
absolutely
the suit.
Not.
And right, that was a really interesting point they made. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have some listener letters. We'll move on to other topics. A lot to get to. Want to quickly check in to Lockbox Central, see how everything's going there. Take care of some business as well. We'll be back in just a moment.
Does he love me? I want to know. How can I tell if he loves me so?
Is it in his eyes?
Oh, no, you'll be deceived.
Is it in his eyes?
Oh, no, you'll make believe. If you want to know if he loves you so, it's in his kiss.
That's where it is. Oh, yeah. Or is it in his face?
Oh, no, it's just as strong.
In his morning breath.
Oh,
I mean, the music is great, but just to be called the Shoop Shoop song, I love that. Good morning. We're playing Cher this morning, 80th birthday, and happy birthday to Cher. We've got a lot to talk about this morning, and we are involved in the conversation regarding the fund that has been set up as the result of this legal deal that Trump has set, which is already meeting with bipartisan scrutiny. I mentioned this briefly, but again, and I am curious about this, but the one person who seemed to be the most outspoken on this was John Thune. And I find that to be fascinating and wonder where that will go from his outrage to action.
I suspect nowhere, Joe, and I don't want to be overly
pessimistic. That's what I thought.
I don't want to be overly pessimistic about this or cynical. If you are an American conservative, you should be more outraged about this than anyone else. But you know, I'm sure we'll get to the subject of Congressman Massey and others, and Republican senators, by and large, have placed their own political careers, their own survival, ahead of the national interests here, in my view. And I'm very, very, very sorry to say that, but it's clear that Donald Trump has the power within the MAGA base, within what's left of the Republican Party, to dictate who survives and who dies. So I'm sure, you know, Majority Leader Thune was quite sincere in his reaction. By all accounts, he is a decent human being, a person of considerable character. But I don't think his objection, I don't think his reaction is really going to have legs within the Republican Party.
Let's go to some of our letters, and we'll then move on to other subjects. We go to Vincent. Blatant and disgusting corruption that sends a message loud and clear that people can indeed stand above the law, and if our leaders are not obeying the law, why should we? That from Vincent. From Vincent to Florian, who writes, too many words, my dear panelists, too many words. You just need one, kleptocracy. Then we go to Matt, who says the Treasury's judgment fund has set on the shelf since 1956, a permanent appropriation Congress built so it wouldn't have to vote on each judgment against the United States. Every transparency bill aimed at it has died under both parties. Trump didn't build this machinery, he inherited it. The way he inherited the unitary executive theory, the post-9/11 surveillance architecture, and a Supreme Court willing to grant the office immunity for official acts. I don't know if he inherited that, but okay. Senate Democrats answer with press releases while their fundraising emails warn that democracy is ending tonight. The donor pitch is louder than the institutional response it claims to fund. What we are watching is not the breach, it is the design working as built.
Okay, I think one part of that letter I disagree with. The issue about the fund, this isn't anything. Trump has a legitimate complaint at the heart of this. His tax information was illegally released.
Check.
A man is going to jail for that.
5 years.
If Trump wanted to civilly sue that individual, or I bet you if he said, look, I'm going to wait when I'm not president, I'm going to sue the government. I bet you there'd be a way to cut a reasonable deal there. And he gets $1,000 per occurrence. And if he shows the court real harms, he can get money from that fund. This is not that. So let's not say that the fund that existed on the shelf, even though it had a lack of transparency, I assume the lack of transparency was because they were covering for misdeeds of legislators, but I don't know that for a fact. Now, the part of the agreement that I love is where the letter writer, I presumed it was a he, I recall it was a he,
yes.
But
yes.
Where he says that their fundraising emails are of more urgency and verbal potency than their actual arguments in governance. I actually think that's great. I'm thinking maybe what I should do is just print those things out and turn them around and send them back to the folks who send them to me and say, well, why don't you get on this? Because you're my elected representative.
Totally. Yep.
Finally, before we move on to other topics, Maggie writes and says, the first rock concert I ever attended was in 1964 at the War Memorial in Rochester, New York. I was 14, and Sonny and Cher were the opening act for the Beach Boys.
All right. Wow.
That's a pretty cool double bill.
Yes.
And good for you for, thank you for sharing that, and thank you for having that memory. That's wonderful. All right. So let's talk about what Fred was talking about just a moment ago of some of the, you know, why are Republican lawmakers concerned about speaking up against President Trump? Well, we saw a couple cases of this yesterday. Representative Thomas Massey loses the GOP primary, the latest casualty of Trump's wrath. Massey lost to a Trump-endorsed candidate in Kentucky after repeatedly defying the president. And the Trump's efforts to exile his critics from the GOP in this case seemed to work. Is it Ed Galrain? Am I right on that? Ed Galrain, a farmer and former Navy SEAL recruited by Trump, beat Massey in the most expensive U.S. House primary on record, the Associated Press projects. The race drew more than $32 million in ad spending. Trump allies and pro-Israel groups long opposed to Massey invested heavily, testing the president's grip on the Republican base. Few Republicans in Congress have clashed more bitterly with Trump over the past year than Massey, who has bucked the GOP on key votes and against Trump's wishes, led a bipartisan effort that forced the release of the government's full files on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Mark.
Joe, what Donald Trump has shown us with this and with his endorsement of Paxton in Texas is that he would risk a Senate seat in order to pick up an incremental, I don't know, 5% of loyalty. I mean, Cornyn has voted some 90%+ with the president.
Let me just give a little background on that real quick. But President Trump endorsed Ken Paxton, the Texas Attorney General, for Senate yesterday, embracing a MAGA ally over Senator John Cornyn in the final days before their key primary race. Mr. Trump's decision to oppose a respected veteran senator comes as he has sought to consolidate power over his party in primaries ahead of the fall midterm elections. That from the New York Times. Back to you.
This further reinforces my concern that the Trump slush fund has underscored, which is the following. You know, Trump's in the kitchen and he's basically saying, I'm going to take out the fire alarm because what I plan to do is a little risky and I don't want it going off. He's decided that loyalists, part of this is retribution, but I fear that he's decided that complete loyalists are so valuable to him that he doesn't really see a difference between somebody who thinks a little bit independently some of the time and a James Tallarico. So for him, Cornyn and Tallarico, I guess, were the same because they weren't 100% mega loyalists. And I worry what it is. I believe that this what Trump plans to do. I think this slush fund and the abuse that it represents is only an appetizer for what Trump plans to do during his next 2 years in office. And he wants to clear the field of anyone who will get in his way, because for him, the difference between a Democrat and a 94% loyal Republican is they're the same, given where he plans to push things to the extreme. We are in the kitchen. He's ripped out that smoke detector.
Sophia?
I'm confused how Trump is able to punish his critics in elections when his own approval rating is so low. Like, Republican primary voters, you know, they're so loyal. They have no tolerance for Trump dissenters. But if Trump's own followers, the rating of the president is so low, how is there no tolerance for dissenters? I don't understand how he's able to punish his critics when his own approval is so low.
It's not, I think his approval rating is not so low among Republicans, and this is why he is concentrating on Republican primaries. He knows this is the one place where his Republican critics are vulnerable electorally. I mean, look, I think President Trump understands there's virtually nothing he can do to alienate this this MAGA base, okay, which is probably 90% of the Republican Party. It could be upwards of 40% of our electorate nationally. He can't alienate them. And for this base, Donald Trump is the guy who understands their alienation from a political system that, in their view, rewards people like immigrants, people of color at their expense. They get it. He understands us. I mean, personally, I've always believed that if you are a physically and mentally able white male born in the United States, you are, to use a baseball analogy, you're born on second base. Okay, that's always right. That's always been my view. If you can't make it home, it's nobody else's fault. If you get picked off second base, it's no one else's fault. It's not the fault of people of color. It's not the fault of Jews. It's not the fault of immigrants, whether they're legal or not. But there is this sense of victimization out there into which President Trump has tapped with really unprecedented success. His supporters are content to let him do as he pleases as long as he upholds and celebrates their victim status. And they're prepared to destroy politically any Republican who opposes him, even on matters that they say are of great interest to them, matters like Jeffrey Epstein, deficit spending, endless wars, etc. So this is what we're looking at.
I wish there was some understanding with loyalists or people on the fence that this is my history teacher perspective, that one day there's going to be a reckoning for all this. You know, when we read history books about government corruption or wars or long ago genocides or awful things, sometimes I think there's a distance that we feel that makes it seem like it wasn't as urgent at the time. And I, like, right now we know how World War II ended. We know how South African apartheid ended. We know the Berlin Wall fell. But when we read about how times of war and violence come to an end, if we didn't live through it, especially for my generation, I feel like we tend to forget that it took action at a time where it was uncertain and they couldn't read that book and know how it ended. We can't just read ahead to the next chapter. So I don't know. I feel like I'm offering some optimism where I think, I believe things will end one day. There will be a reckoning. Trump will not be president for the rest of time. And it's going to take Republicans standing up, conservatives standing up, and Democrats fighting unlawful behavior and standing up for honesty, respect, democracy, and what this country's values should be. Because when it comes to an end, I want voters and politicians to really think hard about what page you want to be on that history book. If you're a religious person, you might think, well, in the afterlife, there'll be someone to answer to. But here on Earth, when your descendants ask about this time in 50 years or more, they're going to wonder if and how you did something against the greed or violence. Did you take part in it? Were you a bystander? And if we have a president or a political family or large company above the law acting as they wish, doing as they wish, and there's no consequences, that's a monarchy. And it's very ironic, we're celebrating in July this semi-quincentennial that over the course of 250 years, we've circled back to a monarchy. I think we have to really think about what things we can do to stop this and prevent this.
I don't disagree with anything you just said.
And absolutely
it was
not.
And it was beautifully said.
Yes.
I do think it is worth noting, however, that many on the right see what is happening now as their reckoning.
But say more.
Meaning that they feel as though they have been put aside, cast aside, not
victimized.
Victimized. And now they're getting their comeuppance. Now, I agree with everything you said. Mm-hmm. I just think, and you see this obviously with Trump and the messaging of especially the 2024 campaign,
mm-hmm.
And how that message resonated with people. Now, and that's because of the great polarization between in this nation. Will that settle itself? I hope so. I don't know.
I think also, I'd love to have your view on this, but, you know, there's this old cliche about history is written by the winners. Okay? So I find it amazing that, you know, some of these Republican politicians who are saluting Donald Trump in the same way that Soviet bureaucrats used to salute Stalin with these over-the-top remarks seem to have no interest in how their performance is going to be viewed by their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren forever. Okay, mm-hmm. So I very much support what you just said. If I could say just a few words about something Mark brought up, the race in Texas.
Yeah, got about
if we got
a minute, go ahead.
Okay, for the Democrats to have a chance of picking up this Senate seat in Texas, it's absolutely necessary that Mr. Paxton be the Republican nominee,
right,
the person just endorsed by President Trump. If Senator Cornyn still manages to win the primary despite President Trump's endorsement of Paxton, I think the race is over. Cornyn would beat the Democrat, James Tallarico, and the Republican Party would be holding on to an important Senate seat. Paxton is the very definition of a totally flawed candidate. There's no third rail corruption opportunity he has missed grabbing during his absolutely appalling political career. But Trump sincerely believes that his personal endorsement is a near guarantee of victory, especially in a state where Republicans have tended to dominate over the last several decades.
We're going to take a break. Those of us in this room are going to get all riled up again, and we'll come back at you with a lot of thoughts on a lot of other different, many other different issues. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll take a break, go over to Pledge Central as well.
Said the things I said. Pride's like a knife, it can cut deep inside. Words are like weapons, they wound sometimes. I didn't really mean to hurt you.
Words are like weapons, they wound sometimes. Don't forget that. Thank you, Cher. We welcome you back to the roundtable. Very nice to be here with you in your company. And we thank all of you for joining us. And thank you for helping out with the lockbox this morning. You can keep it all going and keep the money coming in. 1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. Okay, does anybody have anything else to say on our last subject about what is currently happening electorally in this nation? All right, then we move on to other issues. We go to this story. And this is one that Mark sent me, and so I'm going to just sort of set this up briefly and then throw it over to him because I think he wants to ask Fred about it. So we'll just be flies on the wall. There was a piece in The Economist, and it is the title of that piece is Vladimir Putin is losing his grip on Russia. And the subtitle, His Every Move to Preserve Power Accelerates Decay, writes a former senior official in the Russian government. I'll turn it over to Mark, but why did this strike your interest?
Well, I'm just as interested in the ambassador's views as I am of Sophia's. And the question is this. The Ukrainians, if you believe them, and I think it's a pretty credible assertion, they are killing Russian soldiers mostly via drone as fast as Russia now can constrict them. Conscript them into the army. Thank you. Drones, not snakes. And that war is getting to a point that it seems the balance of power has and the balance of momentum has changed into the hands of the Ukrainians, and maybe permanently so. And the one question that keeps coming to the forefront of my mind is, just as our president needs a credible off-ramp in Iran where he can basically declare victory and retreat, I wonder if the West isn't missing something by not thinking creatively about how to allow Putin to declare victory and retreat, because I do believe that Putin is at risk within his own country. And I highlight the fact that of the two leaders involved in this conflict directly, only one of them has vacated his capital for fear of his life. And that was Putin when he thought that Yevgeny Prigozhin was on the road to Moscow. So I'm just curious, given where the conflict in Ukraine stands now, and maybe I'm being a little bit optimistic about the outcome, but how my fellow panelists think about it and think about what the West should be doing to maximize the chances of an end of the conflict.
Mark, first of all, thanks for recommending this essay. It was an incredibly interesting read. Years ago, when I was writing something about Russian support for the dictator in Syria, Bashar al-Assad, I described Vladimir Putin rather uncharitably as a lowercase Mussolini. Even though it's belated, I'd like to correct the record on that and apologize for that characterization, because I think Vladimir Putin, in fact, is an uppercase Mussolini. Like Mussolini, Vladimir Putin is a supremely cynical, self-serving individual who has delusions of grandeur and is running his country into the ground by fighting a totally useless war. And like Mussolini, he's looting the country's wealth for himself and his supporters. Unlike Mussolini, however, and this, in my view, is what makes him an uppercase Il Duce, Putin seems to have cobbled together a security system that makes his removal very, very problematic, very difficult. I don't rule out the possibility that he might be set aside, perhaps with the Russian military playing a major role. But unlike Mussolini, I don't think in this case he's going to have to flee the capital and end up dangling at the end of a rope. As the essay suggests, however, it's precisely the longevity of this character that's going to guarantee Russia's decline in the years to come. This will be good for the security of Europe and good for the security of the United States. I think it would be a major accomplishment if President Trump were to help accelerate matters in this direction by going all out in supporting Ukraine. But I think we'll have to wait a few years to see if the United States is going to rejoin the West, from which it's seceded, and to see if the United States is going to try to resume its role as the leader of the free world. And this won't be easy. Even if President Trump's successor is someone who really wants to do these things, it's not going to be easy, because the trust we've forfeited may be irreplaceable.
Sophia.
Thanks for sharing this essay, Mark. It was really an interesting read, and for your insights. And I was probably most interested in reading about the Russian social shift away from Putin and kind of how it parallels our American situation, where we don't want to take credit for our leaders' madness. And what I mean by that is, so I'll give a little anecdote. I love traveling. I love studying abroad. I always love talking to new people. And I lived in Ireland for a few months as a college freshman in 2019. And before you go abroad, there's a lot of classes you take and orientations on what to expect culturally when you go overseas, you know, like, and something you're told a lot is people will ask you about politics, and specifically, they will think your president is crazy, probably, and want to ask you what you think and about that. And granted, I was only 18 then, and maybe people just assumed I had a good head on my shoulders, so they were asking less. But my experience was, when I went over, international people were not bombarding me with political questions, assuming I was a Trump voter. Instead, there was almost a common understanding or sympathy of a separation between what the American people want and what Trump does. And it was less of an ambush of, how could you vote for him? What are your thoughts right now? And more, wow, you guys are going through a lot right now, huh? And what was going over there? And granted, at the time, Brexit was happening and a prime minister was stepping down, so that may have been on Europeans' minds more. But what I mean is, we are saying it's not the U.S. war against Iran, it's Trump's war. It's not Russia's war against Ukraine that Russians are saying now, it's Putin's war. And like I mentioned earlier, that we want to be on the right side of history books later. So I'm thinking there's a shift happening with Russians now that I almost want to caution, or at least think about the difference between this and not taking responsibility for our country's actions completely. I know people my age who didn't vote in the 2024 election because they told me they felt like their vote didn't matter, or they just didn't feel like going, and that was quite upsetting. There's some white privilege, I feel, in that, in not voting because a person in the majority feels like things don't affect them. And what I'm circling to is that I think that Russians are distancing themselves from Putin, which we know is a very brave thing to do because Putin has been known to punish his opposers, sometimes lethally. But I want to see this sentiment translate into some action. This is some taking responsibility for what this country is doing. And I think Putin's allies specifically, they're going to have to stand up to him more, maybe militarily, maybe on the citizen level. But I'm really interested to see how this cultural shift is going to actually translate into change and action.
Well said. And of course, we have Putin in China, and that would always be momentous, but obviously we look at it through the lens of having President Trump just in China, and I think it's impossible not to contrast the two, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although the welcoming ceremonies appear to have been identical. Kids jumping up and down with flags and all that. So I think Xi and China made sure that Putin was going to have the equivalent welcome that Trump did. Mark raised a good point, and it's well worth pondering. Is there an exit ramp for Putin? To get him out of Ukraine? If you use the Iran analogy, it is very, very clear. It's clear to anybody, regardless of where your news comes from. It is very clear that President Trump is looking for an exit ramp. That he's fed up with this excursion. It no longer interests him. He wants it done. He wants to move on to something else, whether it's Cuba or whatever. I'm just not seeing any evidence yet, and I'm not saying it's not there, but I'm just not seeing that Putin is looking for an exit ramp. If he wants one, I suspect the ingredients are there. There would be a territorial adjustment of some kind recognized by the United States. There would probably be some kind of a provision whereby Ukraine might be permitted to join the European Union, but never NATO. There are ingredients there. I think that what's lacking so far is any evidence that Vladimir Putin is interested. What he seems to be more interested in is maintaining a campaign of pure terror against the civilians of Ukraine, and it's not for nothing that he's been indicted for war crimes.
Do you think the war would end if Ukraine ceded some land to Russia, just so Putin could say he won, even if it was small?
I think as a practical matter, the Ukrainians have to be open to some territorial adjustments. I mean, look, I suspect even if there were an honest referendum run by the United Nations or something like that, Crimea, a majority of Crimeans would opt to be in the Russian Federation. Okay, most of the people who live in Crimea are ethnic Russians. During the Soviet Union, Crimea was put in the Ukrainian, whatever it was called, a province or whatever. So, mm-hmm. So that's an adjustment. There are probably parts of eastern Ukraine, not the whole thing, but parts of eastern Ukraine corresponding to the current front lines that might ultimately be ceded to Russian sovereignty. Would the Ukrainians be open to this? They won't like it. They won't like it a bit. But would they be open to it? I suspect so.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I'll go back to Mark, and we'll finish up our time together. We welcome you. Any questions you have on items that we've discussed this morning, we welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Don't forget the lockbox, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. We'll be going back to Sarah and Maddie and Lockbox Central at 11:30 this morning, and we look forward to that, and we look forward to you doing your thing whenever possible. We'll be right back.
When love is truly right,
this time it's true.
It lives from year to year.
It changes as it goes, oh, and on the way it grows, but it never disappears. After all the stars.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Listening to Cher, it was a duet, and Mark, I was enjoying the music. Mark turned to me and said, "Your editor, I think, wants you to go back on the air." I was like, "Well, that's fair." We welcome you. We have stuff to talk about, and it's panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. So you posed this and assigned us this reading. I'm interested. I'm not sure we actually got your thoughts on it.
Well, my thoughts, maybe I'm more optimistic than Fred. Before Donald Trump threw Vladimir Putin an economic life preserver, his economic airways were constricting pretty quickly. The cost of waging this war, particularly of luring service members into the Russian army, has become a profound drag on the economy. Putin himself has said that he thinks that there may be an end of the war, signaling most pundits thought that what he really was saying is we're not going to resort to a general conscription. I got the word
easy
right
enough
this time.
For you to say.
Yeah,
yes.
And so maybe I'm optimistic that the end is that we're nearer to the end than the beginning of this, but I do grant that typically these things end with what I call sort of a warm truce where you're behind battle lines lobbing ordnance at one another, but it's not a hot war anymore. So my thought, Joe, was that it really does behoove the West to help Putin figure out what the situation looks like and find something that's palatable to him so that we can end the conflict. And the cost of this conflict obviously has been substantial, and I think we need to acknowledge that it's been substantial on both sides. I hold no ill will towards those poor Russians who, if you watch on YouTube now, you can see these videos of them being ended by these personal view drones one by one, and it's just a horrible sight. Mm. And obviously the plight on the Ukrainians is heart-wrenching as well. So maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I do think the end may be on the horizon, and I think it behooves the West to help put Putin in a situation where he can exit but not fear for his future. I don't really care about Russia's future so much as I do care about ending the war, frankly. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Mark, and I would just add that I think we can assist Mr. Putin in coming to the right conclusions. We can facilitate his thought process best by making a major investment in the defense of Ukraine, in making it very, 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 very clear to him that this is a losing proposition. I mentioned during one of the breaks that my approach to Vladimir Putin, my preferred approach would be to sort of quote Harry Truman, beat him and make him like it. I think that's the best approach to this guy, and let him figure things out. I think if Vladimir Putin comes to the conclusion that the system he's built in Russia, a system of industrial scale looting, if that system is endangered, and if some kind of compromise on Ukraine can reduce that danger, then he'll do it. He'll do it in a heartbeat because, tactically, he's a very adept and very thoughtful person. And preserving the system that has enriched him and his cronies is everything for Vladimir Putin.
I will say globally, to just widen the lens out a little bit, the one thing I will give the Trump administration credit for, yes, I did set that as a preamble to the following statement, is if we decide as a country that we are going to set up economic sanctions, the Trump administration, as I understand it, I'm not unaware of when in the past we sort of hunted down these vessels that were sending oil from or to the wrong place in contravention of our sanctions and really tightening that noose. We did that. We've done that with Cuba. We started to do that a bit with Iran and with Russia. And my view is if you're going to have those things in place, I do think you ought to really do it. And I think the argument about this historical argument about do sanctions really work? The answer is heck yes. If you look at Venezuela, you look at Cuba, you look at Russia.
They work.
They are. We can. It's right to argue about the morality of them, and certainly Cuba is a clear case of that. But the issue of do they work, I think, has been settled with what we've seen in the last couple of years. And the answer, I think, is if you're going to have them in place, then you ought to pursue them, relentlessly. And I even think now, with respect to broaden this out even a little bit more, if I were Trump, I would look for ways to have some of those Iranian pipelines out of the country to accidentally explode and hope the Israelis can help me with that. Because if you're playing for time on both sides of this, which you are for the foreseeable future, you've got to tighten the noose on the other side of this equation.
And in this case, I mean, in the lead up to the decision to go to war with Iran or to do the excursion, whatever it's called, our president was cautioned by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, say, look, the Iranians could shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and all of a sudden you're going to have international economic implications, the likes of which maybe we haven't seen for a while. The president's response was reportedly, I'm not worried about that. They're not going to last long enough to do that. Well, wrong. All right. So then the president is faced with a dilemma. The price of gasoline is going up almost every day. And one of his responses to that is, I'm going to lift the sanctions on Russia. An absolute windfall Vladimir Putin.
And I'd like to say on the oil front, by the way, we ain't seen nothing yet. We will see 150 barrel oil if this continues, and 5 to 550 gas. It's gonna get ugly. There are lots of outlets, including The Economist, that are really mad because the futures market doesn't reflect that. Well, that's not what the futures market's for. And so the futures market is a market for insurance policies. It's not a market predicting. It's funny. The Economist said in its own print, the futures market always does a lousy job of predicting the future. But why aren't they getting oil prices right, the fact that this is going to get really ugly? Well, they answered the question in their own lead up. And let me just say, this summer and the expenses of gas, it is going to be gruesome.
I think of no better way of leaving our audience than by saying, you know what? It's going to be gruesome. So we will do exactly that. We have a whole other hour to make up for the gruesomeness, I promise you. And we'll try our best to do exactly that. My thanks to our wonderful group this morning, Fred, Sophia, Mark. You're all wonderful. Thank you very much.
Pleasure, Joe.
Happy birthday, Cher.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, God.
There's a good
send
note
a card. Yeah, good on you. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll have a whole other hour of this program right after this.